I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man that said the sort of thing that Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on a level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as an evil demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. So we're back here in our series on C.S. Lewis. This is Cole Fakes. I'm joined again by Ben Williams and Terry Fakes. We've covered C.S. Lewis's life in the first three episodes, and now we're turning to look at C.S. Lewis's impact, primarily through his great works. We're looking at Mere Christianity today, maybe his most famous work. We'll be looking at his fiction. We'll be looking at his academic career. We'll be looking at his lasting legacy for us today. But his apologetics is probably what he's known best for. In fact, this single argument, lunatic, liar, and Lord, is something that you can hear quoted in probably a church somewhere in America every Sunday. This is a lasting piece of Lewis's legacy. And looking at this book, Mere Christianity, is an open door to all of Lewis as an apologist. And Ben, to pick up where we left off last time, it's funny when you read Mere Christianity, and because of the fame and the notoriety that surrounds it, it didn't start out as a book. It started out as something different.
Yeah, one of my favorite editions of the book that I have in my library was a gift to me. And it's a copy of Mere Christianity, but it's interspersed with photographs from World War II era London, which kind of gives you the flavor of it as you're moving through it. The document itself, as we have it, was first a radio broadcast, and it comes from the era of World War II. The BBC is doing radio broadcasts to a pretty diverse audience. I mean, it's all of Britain, but because of the war and interest in news in the war, it's going to a lot of other places in the northern parts of Europe as well. And because of their near monopoly on the broadcast of media at the time, they had this peculiar niche they were trying to fill back in 1941. They wanted to have some religious programming, but at the same time, it couldn't be controversial religious programming. If you get one person from a particular Christian franchise or denomination who is proselytizing on the BBC airwaves, that's a problem. It's not going to work. So it has to be something that is religious, and it's British, so it better be Christian, and yet it had to be broadly acceptable enough that it could go out to a war-weary culture without making people turn the radio back off and make them angry. And so they were looking for just a near impossible thing that, to our common perception, we think of religion as one of the topics you avoid at dinner because it's just always controversial. They wanted to talk about Christianity in a meaningful way, but at the same time, wasn't going to cause resentment and anger among the audience that was just trying to understand what was going on in the world. It's also kind of a foil of what does our culture say about the world as opposed to what's coming over Germany's airwaves? What's the difference between our values and what Hitler says society is all about? So it was a very important thing, but also very specific. J.W. Welch, who is the director of the religious department of the BBC at the time in 1941, had read The Problem of Pain by C.S. Lewis, thought he was great, and so sent him a letter and said, would you consider taking on this task? Lewis seems to have a little hesitation, but is still eager to do his part and outlines what I read the outline is a fairly nuanced approach to Christian thinking of you're going to put that on the British airways, but he does it in such a winsome way. Welch buys in, and sure enough, they do these series of broadcasts, which are what would become Mere Christianity. Starts out in kind of a bad time slot, but immediately becomes popular and gets elevated to a better time slot. And then over the years gets turned into transcripts and then into books in the format today that we have. And we are ever so grateful that this gift was bestowed upon us by the BBC. We'll say praise be that they took the time to put some good broadcasting on the airways, and we have Mere Christianity as a result.
That's a good point that you make, Ben, is that if, had they chosen a cleric, a professional theologian, they would have then put this into either an Anglican box or a Presbyterian box or something like that. So they take the unprecedented step of getting a layman. Now, C.S. Lewis is an educated man, but he's not a theologian. So they get a layman to talk about Christianity. And you can really tell that he takes that kind of an approach. It's not an academic book. In fact, the book is broken into four sections. The talks were grouped in four major sections. And if you think about it, it takes a what I call a really common sense approach. The first section is entitled Right and Wrong as a Clue to the Meaning of the Universe. And he basically looks at what we would call natural law and just talks about how reasonable it might be to suppose that there is a God in the universe. And he makes that argument simply from the way we're wired in terms of our morality and our natural law. In the second section, he moves on a little bit and he says, well, what do Christians believe then? You know, what do they believe about God, and what do they believe about the meaning of the universe? And then in the third section, he moves on and says, well, that's what Christians think. What do Christians do? And so he talks about Christian behavior. And then in the final set of talks, he talks about, it's called Beyond Personality, or the First Steps in the Doctrine of the Trinity. And this gets into a little deeper ideas about the personal nature of God. And the one of the unique ideas of Christianity is that God is three in one. So what I like about this, Cole, is that he takes a layman's common sense approach through these talks.
Yeah, that has to be part of the enduring appeal of Lewis. I mean, there's a reason that he's inspired many, many of the great minds of Christianity today. I mean, if you just think about who has C.S. Lewis on their Mount Rushmore of thinkers, you've got Tim Keller and N.T. Wright, Alistair McGrath and Doug Wilson, and many, many people who you say they have a respect for Lewis as a deep and very sophisticated thinker. On the flip side, Mere Christianity is even more popular today than it was when it came out. I mean, millions of copies are being sold and they're being read in coffee shops and they're being read at, you know, before bed by people who wouldn't consider themselves academic theologians, but who have a deep connection with the way that C.S. Lewis writes and the level of his thinking. I can remember reading Mere Christianity for the first time and being surprised by how rigorous it is. It's not an easy read, but the reasoning is easy. It's like C.S. Lewis shows his work. And one of the things, too, I think that characterizes this book as we start to get into some of the arguments that he makes is Lewis, as George Marsden said, is a poet through and through. And even when he's doing apologetics, what you realize is it's the metaphors, it's the images, it's the similes that carry the load. They do the heavy lifting, even in something like Mere Christianity.
A lot of his method is one that appeals to the imagination as much as it does to the mind. I mean, I know the imagination is part of the mind, but not just the intellect, not just the rigorously logical. The logic is there, but it's often also couched in the language of imagination, of pictures. He's excellent at painting a picture, of giving you a variety of senses on which something may be used, and allowing you to see it from a different point of view.
Ben, that's a really good point to make, because I know that in this podcast we have to look at sections of his work, but I think it would be a mistake to look at Mere Christianity and talk about the method without realizing he also wrote fiction. And he also created worlds in his mind. And so do you see that harmony of, like you just said, imagination informing his intellect?
Especially, I notice it in the Christian behavior section, which might be a funny place to put imagination. But when he talks about just how Christians conceive of morality, he talks about we're headed to a world where we would only speak of rules and commandments as if they are a joke. One of my favorite lines. And you might, it sounds funny, like, of course, morality is not a joke. Morality is very serious. But he means it to say that what we're heading to is this new man, this new kind of being with God that he captures in Great Divorce, and you get it in the Space Trilogy, his image of what we're becoming. And in his mind, if you understood what we were becoming, what God is making of us, then the rules we have would not only make more sense, you almost would forget they're there because you'd be focused on becoming more of what God's making of you. And so by helping you to imagine the whole trajectory of morality, he gets you past nitpicking and fighting over very specific rules, which has a place. I mean, there's a reason you have rules, and he covers rules. He talks about chastity. He talks about some difficult topics. He talks about divorce. Can you imagine making that sales pitch to the BBC? I want to talk about divorce to a million listeners on a Tuesday afternoon. But he says all of that is better understood in the big picture of what Christianity, what God is trying to accomplish by means of this thing we call Christianity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he takes, if you look at the way that he lays out mere Christianity and the kinds of arguments he makes, he uses that appeal to the everyman, to the common nature that we have, and then makes apologetics and theological arguments. And so the first section, instead of doing something like, and these things are good, the argument from design or, the constants of the universe or something like that to prove the existence of God. Instead, what he does is he creates this picture from the law, Ben, like you're talking about. And then he says, the idea is that somebody or something from beyond the material universe is actually getting at us. And I expect when I reached that point, some of you felt a certain annoyance, he says. So it's that somebody's knocking at the door here, and the door is the way that we are wired. He's appealing to that common nature to then say, something's got to explain this. If we were to put a biblical verse to it, it'd be like when in Ecclesiastes, eternity is written on our hearts. God has designed us in such a way that these things resonate. And then Lewis is able to step in and say, well, maybe that's the proof of the existence of God.
And it's a great moment for that argument because bombs are falling on Britain. This is World War II. So maybe in the teacher's lounge at Oxford, it made sense to say morality is relative and right and wrong are social constructs and none of them have any absolute value. But can you really look the people of Britain in the face and say that there's not evil in the world? And then if you acknowledge there's evil in the world, what does that mean? Where does that come from? Why do we think Hitler's wrong? It was just a perfect moment to make that case, as opposed to maybe some other. Like, again, there may be a moment for the teleological argument. Mm-hmm. This was the moment for an argument for morality, and he just nails it.
That's really well said, because you have to remember the backdrop of what he's writing. But what I think explains why this book has lasted so long is it makes sense in a very similar way in our backdrop. One of my favorite illustrations that he uses early in the book, I think about when you talk about human behavior today, we don't cast it so much, we've got a Hitler and we've got a war, good and evil. He talks about that, and that's a great backdrop. We have more of we are all the product of mindless evolution, and consequently, we're animals who have instincts. And I'll read you this passage where he talks about that. And he says, suppose you hear a cry for help from a man in danger. You will feel two instincts. One is a desire to help. That's your herd instinct. The other is a desire to keep out of danger. That's your instinct for self-preservation. I mean, he could be talking to modern evolutionists. He said, but inside, you will find that in addition to these two impulses, there's a third thing that tells you that you ought to follow the impulse to help. And I love the way he frames that, and so simply, just says there's not only good and evil in the world, but when you think of us as, you want to explain it as just instinct, that every single person out there knows by experience that we have a sense of oughtness inside us. And he's going to ask the question, where does that come from? Who put that inside us?
Yeah, I think this argument from desire is one of the strongest arguments in Lewis. And it's also where you see, and this is something that makes Lewis who he is, when he's at his intellectual best, he's often at his rhetorical best, which is reverse of a lot of people. And all of us who teach frequently here know the feeling of being at your intellectual worst and compensating by being at your rhetorical best. And Lewis, though, I've actually found that there are several times in here where Lewis is going to, he's going to make these really powerful intellectual arguments, and that's where he's going to harness his ability to explain things through image. And so at one point in the third section of Mere Christianity, he says, if I find in myself a desire which no experience of this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove that the universe is a fraud. Probably earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. I think that, and several others, we could read, you know, six or seven of these from Mere Christianity alone, is Lewis at his absolute best.
Well, and one of the things that I like about him, and here's how I'll characterize everything we've just said. It may be a lot of things, but it's at least clear. I think, even though you're right, Cole, that this isn't an easy read, it's not a simple read, but it is, does have a lot of clarity. And these examples seem to me that Lewis had a knack for bringing a little clarity to complicated situations.
When you get into the third section of the book and we start talking about Christian morality, that would be an area where you see this shine through again. Is it's one thing to go about talking about the existence of God, the desires, the, you know, kind of use the everyman impulse to talk about theology, but it's surprising in some ways that he uses that same approach when he gets to morality, because I think many of us, if we were pushed into a corner, would say that's something that you can really only learn by revelation, you know, because our impulses, our sinful impulses, are so off from what God commands that you can't possibly just appeal to what's written on our hearts to get to the kinds of moral teaching that you find in the New Testament.
He has a knack for acknowledging both of those truths. That on the one hand, he says, I know morality is true because I believe in a sense of morality that says I'm wrong. And if I made it up, it would say I was right all the time. You know, the fact that we're judged by our own morality tells us we didn't invent it. So he recognizes kind of that conflict between our moral intuition and our fallenness. But then at the same time, he does acknowledge what in natural theology or even Aristotelian philosophy is this idea of a natural moral intuition, that fallen we may be, but there is something there in human nature that remains of God's image or something, what call it what you will, this intuition that we can determine or at least have a hunch of which direction morality is leaning. He gives the illustration of a fleet of ships that you know it's good morality if the ships don't run into each other, the ships don't sink, and the ships get where they're going. Well, that's kind of intuitive, and we kind of intuitively know what sorts of things sink the ship or make them run into each other. Of those, maybe the hardest is where are we going, which is what Christianity supplies, but that there are some destructive tendencies in human morality is obvious to all of us. We know it, even when we're doing it. What's Paul say? The thing I don't want to do, I do. We know it even when we're doing it. And so he appeals to that in a way that is easy to get on an intuitive level.
I agree. I like that illustration a lot. You know, he made the metaphor that we're each a ship, and one of the things people look at is they would say all we need are social rules to say don't crash your ship into somebody else's. In other words, you can do whatever you want as long as it doesn't hurt someone else. But he rebuts that a little bit, and he says that's not sufficient. he says, what is the good of telling the ships how to steer so that they avoid collisions if, in fact, they are such crazy old tubs that they cannot be steered at all? Yeah. And so his point is that you do need rules of human behavior, but there's something inside of us that is off kilter. And if he goes on to say, what is the good of drawing up rules for social behavior if we know that, in fact, our greed or cowardice or self-conceit are going to prevent us from keeping them? And so he wants to situate this not in a social manner, but he wants to get back to the individual and how we need to be wired right.
Yeah, to that point, I think as we think a little bit about the critiques that Lewis has received with Mere Christianity, one of them comes along these lines of how he conceives of ethics. And because he's doing Mere Christianity, anybody that wants to get more specific than Lewis is then looking back and saying, oh, he's not specific enough. But rereading Mere Christianity for this podcast, I was actually pretty amazed at how specific he does get on the ethical side of things. And he always does it from that point of there's something wrong internally that we should be able to notice. And so chastity is the great example of this, because it was as unpopular in his day to advance a social ethic of Christianity as it is today. And so he says, chastity is the most unpopular of Christian virtues. There's no getting away from it. The Christian rule is either marriage with complete faithfulness to your partner or else total abstinence. Now, this is so difficult and so contrary to our instincts that obviously either Christianity is wrong or our sexual instinct as it is now has gone wrong. So a lot of people, if you're doing apologetics here, would just reject that dichotomy altogether and say, actually, we can trust our instincts. You know, there's a lot of this conversation. Our instincts should lead us to the truth. But then he does something absolutely ingenious, because if you set it up that way, what you've got to show then is what we take as our natural instinct is actually wrong. The things that we desire are actually wrong. And this is one of my favorite illustrations in the whole book. From the first time I read this, I thought this was so brilliant. He says that he goes on a little bit and he's going to prove that our desires are wrong. He says, now, suppose you come to a country where you could fill a theater by simply bringing a covered plate onto the stage and then slowly lifting the cover so as to let everyone see just before the lights went out that it contained a mutton chop or a bit of bacon. Would you not think that in that country something had gone wrong with the appetite for food? And would not anyone who had grown up in a different world think there's something equally queer about the state of the sex instinct among us? And of course, he's using this to basically refer to, as he puts it, a striptease. And so in a roundabout way, appealing to actually what we all know to be true, again, he proves that what many of us desire is not true. And I love that he's able to thread that needle of, actually, I can prove to you your desires are not true, or there's something wrong with your desires, by appealing to your sense about what should be desirable. And by doing that, I'll show you that actually what I said is correct.
In my edition, I wrote in a note in the margin that says he clearly never watched the Food Network, or he'd know that he'd be exactly right. Yeah. But he's right, of course. I mean, that there is something so out of whack there, and he gets you to laugh about it. There is so much power in persuasion. If you can get a person to chuckle, it disarms them. It makes them more agreeable to what you're trying to say. And he does it so well of us just drooling over the mutton chop. You know, it makes you laugh. And then he'll do the same thing about kind of a caricature of his own making, perhaps, of the Victorian prude that, you know, he says, a prude could be just as much condemned in his instinct as a prostitute at one point. You know, he's very careful to say that our desires are not too great. They're too little. You know, he doesn't war against desire in that way, and gets you to laugh a little bit at the mutton illustration for the strip tease and for this caricature of a prudish Christian on the other side, in order to say, okay, what would be the healthy sense of desires and where would we learn that from? Mm-hmm. And after he's done, after he set it up, well, you just can't help but agree with him. It just seems so reasonable.
Yeah, exactly. You know, one question for you on that, Ben, it's really interesting to me that he isn't going to situate morality or ethics. I'll just interchange those words for this discussion. He doesn't situate it in a social sense. He situates it, although there's an element of that, he situates it in the individual, but he doesn't put it in our instinct. He really roots it in what I guess we would call virtue. What goes all the way back to the Greeks, the idea of there is such a thing as virtuous behavior. Would you agree with that? That's how he's approaching this?
Absolutely. He is classically Christian to the core in this regard of almost to a fault, setting aside what the scholars call deontological ethics, which is command-based, in favor of a virtue-based. Now, he's still in favor of commands, mm-hmm. but to him, they're the smallest part of the bigger picture. He's going to say, what we really need is not a rule about how to be human, but a picture of what it means to be human, and then identify characteristics in it that usually falls between two extremes. That's the Aristotle's vision of the virtues, was there's a mean between two extremes. So courage, for example, is not fear, but neither is it running into danger because it's fun. Courage is not foolhardy or fearful. Courage is this other thing, and it's in between extremes. Honesty is not lying and deception, but neither is it being rude under the umbrella of honesty. So always there is this mean between extremes, and it's easy because it's not an extreme. It's hard to make rules to define a mean. Extremes are easy. Go as far that way as you can is really easy to say, but act in this moderate zone is harder to define. So what you need is a role model. For Aristotle, it was, I don't know, look for a really good philosopher and hope you find one. For Christians, we say we come with this ready-made vision of Jesus, the perfect man with the perfect virtues. And if you could live up to that model, the rules wouldn't start making more sense to you. In fact, you wouldn't even have to think of the rules. You would just think of the man. And in that way, the whole sense of Christian ethics makes more sense. You're not trying to memorize a set of traffic rules. You're trying to find out what does a human even look like. And Jesus is our model for that. And his characteristics, the cardinal virtues, are there as long with... So just for those who may not be as familiar, Aristotle had four virtues that were the cardinal virtues. And then Thomas Aquinas adds three more that are the Christian virtues, faith, hope, and love. And so Lewis just takes all of those and expands on them and says, now you have a sense of the positive picture of Christianity, which is so important because what people encounter so often, for good reason, is the negative nature of Christian morality. My kids... hear me too often saying, don't do that. Why? Because they're kids and they do dumb things, and I have to say, don't do that. But what we need to be healthy is do this. Here's the positive vision of it. So the world, because it's fallen, hears a lot of the message from Christian of the negative side of it, which is necessary because the world is fallen. But if we don't show them the sensible positive aspect of it, but they never understand it. And that's what Lewis is doing so well, is portraying that in a way that's sensible, almost to the point where you say, why didn't I see that before?
Mm-hmm. You know, if you're going to find that middle zone, one of the things you're going to have is criticism from both sides. Mm-hmm. And that's
how you know you're doing it right.
That's exactly the confirmation that Lewis probably would have relished. And he certainly has gotten criticisms from both sides. And Mere Christianity has received some criticism. I would say maybe two major criticisms. I'll list the first one, which is people that will actually attack that quote that we began the episode with, the lunatic liar Lord. And usually when people critique that, it is from the standpoint of, well, Lewis is just making things overly simple. You know, so even McGrath, who probably, being somebody who's highly sympathetic to Lewis and has a tremendous amount of respect, in his biography on Lewis, will point out that that's actually a little bit more simple than it needs to be. There's another option that Jesus was genuinely wrong about what he was saying that probably should be included there. And so you get these criticisms of mere Christianity. Certainly, if you're kind of a denominational fanatic, you're going to think, well, this is just not even halfway down the road. We need way more than this to get to whatever version of Christianity we think is the exclusive version. And on the flip side, you know, you're going to have people who are just as outraged at Lewis's talk about chastity or whatever other virtue as they would be with arch fundamentalist on the same topic. And so you get some of this with C.S. Lewis from both directions. I think both of those, if you understand what Lewis is trying to do, what we've been discussing, you realize, yeah, it's a 200-page book. I mean, you know, it's aimed at the front door entryway of belief. However, Ben, I would say there probably is one very solid criticism of something not in the book, but something that's left out of the book.
Yeah, N.T. Wright, among others, has pointed out that somehow C.S. Lewis managed to write a book summarizing Christian faith without mentioning the resurrection, or at least not dwelling on it. And this last time when I reread it again, I kind of went looking for that. And he has a fair point that I don't know if it just was not a huge part of Lewis's own theology, or if it was just the confines of format and space. For someone like N.T. Wright, who wrote 900 pages on the resurrection, this is an unforgivable sin. But for the rest of us, it is a strange oversight. If I were summarizing Christian doctrine, it seemed like the resurrection might be in there. But you know, it's been notoriously hard throughout Christian history to summarize the Christian faith. The Apostles' Creed is something I'm pretty fond of. And yet there's some kind of big stuff that's not in there that you might think would be kind of a big deal. The first and second greatest commandment, to love your neighbor and to love your God, is not in the Apostles' Creed. You know, how do you leave the first commandment out? Yeah, it's hard to make a list that gets the most important bits in a coherent way, which is probably why God gave us a big book to say, here's all of it. And then here's 2,000 years of people explaining it. But I think overall, if I were to pick one thing that I wish there was a bit more resurrection in it, or any resurrection in it, I think it would only help his case in his presentation. I would love to have seen his imaginative eye turned toward the doctrine of the resurrection. I think it would have been great, but we don't get that.
Yeah, I'd say that's the fairest critique of mere Christianity, and it is an oversight. I mean, I would say it's a legitimate oversight. I mean, if you're going to say, here's the bare bones, you know, in a book of what you need to believe and think about to be a Christian, you got to have more resurrection than that. So I would say it's a fair critique. It's not a devastating critique in the sense that we would say, oh, you know, you shouldn't read mere Christianity, or it's hopelessly underwhelming. I do wonder, though, I've thought about this as we've been preparing for this podcast, is there something in the cultural waters with Lewis where he doesn't walk into that? I don't sense from any of the other reading we've done that he has cold feet about the resurrection as a doctrine, whereas that certainly was the case in this era. Depending on how plugged in you are to European theology in this time period, there's a lot of people who are trying to get out of believing the resurrection because they have kind of a scientific materialist worldview. I don't sense that at all for Lewis. In fact, everything about what he writes elsewhere would make you think this would be an exclamation point for him as we believe in the resurrection. And so while I don't have any doctrinal doubts on Lewis's broad corpus, you know, it's an odd oversight in mere Christianity.
It is historically during the rise of the most recent rise of what of evangelicalism, kind of contemporaneous with that, and at the risk of getting hateful listener email, evangelicalism as a whole has sometimes had a tendency to so strongly emphasize the doctrine of the cross as to diminish the doctrine of the resurrection. That's a criticism of the whole movement. Certainly N.T. Wright would think so, but even those with less weighty books on the subject said, we probably tend to do that. I did in my preaching for a long time. It just seemed like the cross was so important. Why would I talk about anything else? So right. That's probably fair. But again, as you say, I don't think it's debilitating. in the same way, an evangelical would criticize Lewis that there's not a lot of Bible in Mere Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
It's not what you'd call a biblical theology. It's not book, chapter, verse type instruction or exhortation at all. You can go whole chapters and never hear anything that sounds like a verse from the Bible, which we might find a little disturbing in a Bible class discussion. And even outside of Mere Christianity, there are questions about what even is his view of the Bible. He tends to read it like a literature professor reads anything, with a little bit of skepticism to the text. So that again, a fair question, but I don't think it's a defeating objection. I just think it's a point to bear in mind.
You know, these points, to me, make me want to ask this question, Cole, is as fair as the critiques are, they could really only land a punch if indeed that's what he was trying to do. And so let me ask you this. What do you think Lewis was actually trying to do with Mere Christianity? The critiques will tell you what he didn't do. Maybe it doesn't line up with what we think of as apologetics today. How would you describe what was he trying to do in Mere Christianity?
I think this is the question. I think even more broadly, what is Lewis doing as an apologist? You know, Mere Christianity being example number one. It makes me think of one of Lewis's friends, Austin Farrer, who was a close friend. He was one of the people, one of the very few people that was there for his civil union marriage that we talked about in the last episode. He said, when he's talking about Lewis, he says, "We think we're listening to an argument, but in fact, we are presented with a vision. And it is the vision that carries conviction." And I think that gets us a long way down the road on what Lewis is trying to do as an apologist. I don't think that Lewis is trying to do what we consider academic apologetics, where he is taking, you know, the best arguments against Christianity and knocking them down. I don't think Lewis is writing, and I think maybe this goes a long way to explain some of the oversights on Scripture and the resurrection. I don't think he's writing to a completely secular, post-Christian kind of world like we would think of apologetics. Mm-hmm. I think he's banking on the fact that many of the people that he talks to are at least social Christians, or at least they have a semblance of what Christianity is. I also wonder if, given Lewis's biography, I also wonder if he's writing to people that are in that liminal space between his first conversion to theism and his full conversion to Christianity. Somebody who's sympathetic in some way to what he's saying, but doesn't necessarily have it all fleshed out. When you read Mere Christianity, you get the sense that he is writing in such a way that really appeals to a person who is a person of faith or who is interested in faith and wants a fuller understanding, wants a defense of the faith from the inside. That's where I think Lewis really hits his stride as an apologist, is not just with the hard heels dug in atheists, although I think there have been many people in that spot who have read Mere Christianity and have become Christians. But I think he's even better for the person who is maybe new in their faith or interested in faith, who needs a guide to take them along this journey of doctrine and belief.
I like to highlight maybe four or five elements that I think capture the sense of Lewis's method. The first, as we've pointed out, is it's a common sensibility. He really is appealing to things you probably already believed to be true if you thought about it. You might not even notice that you believed it to be true. It is in that sense what the big shots call natural theology, which I hesitate to say. When we think natural theology, we think of Thomas Aquinas or somebody, and there's a whole chasm between Lewis and Aquinas in terms of genre. But in terms of the appeal to your intuition, that's definitely part of what he's doing. He's defeating caricatures. He is telling you that the make-believe version of Christianity that you don't like doesn't exist anyway, or it shouldn't. And so that's part of his project. He's appealing to coherence, that even if you haven't bought in yet, are you willing to see that Christianity at least makes sense within its own little sphere, that it's internally consistent, that it has some sensibility. It's not an absurdity to believe it. Maybe you're not convinced, but it's not absurd. He's appealing
Ben,
to
on that point, Ben. Go ahead. I want to just comment on that because I think you know, having a PhD in apologetics can take for granted some of the literature that's so eye-opening when you get into it, that there's actually a difference between apologetics as proof, you know, apologetics as proof of the existence of God, and then apologetics as defense, which is actually what the word apologetics means, not apologizing, but making an apology, a defense of the faith to show, hey, I'm not necessarily saying this in a way that it is logically tight and proves beyond a reasonable doubt, but instead I'm writing this so that you can see that a reasonable person can believe with consistency that this is true. And as you're talking, I just wanted to point out that I think in that second category, Lewis is one of the best. I mean, he truly is making a defense. But if you expect him to go out there and say, you know what, we're going to prove that there is a God by logic alone, that's just not the kind of apologetics that he's doing.
Yeah, I think he's making sure you know Christianity is definitely not laughable. It's not absurd. It's not self-contradictory. That if you were to give it a shot, you might be persuaded. But to do that, he has to convince you that it's something worth hearing out. It's the same thing we do in science where we say, does this fit with what we know so far? That's not the same as saying, is it true? It's just saying, does it fit the assumptions and beliefs we currently have? And it's how a lot of human knowledge works. So he does that really well. He also does a good job of pointing out conflict you hadn't noticed in your current point of view. So my point of view makes sense. The one you have might not be as consistent as you think it is. And he picks on the naturalist and the kind of counterintuition that you might appeal to. He's already thought it through. He's ahead of you. And he's going to shake your faith a little bit in the anti-Christian or non-Christian alternative that you already held. And then the fifth element that I like to point out is that it is a defense. It's mere Christianity. It's not mere theism, and it's not mere Anglicanism. So it's more specific than just some sort of God, which is going to irritate somebody who just wants an intellectual theism. He's going to talk about the devil, and he's going to talk about marriage and stuff. It's too specific for them. At the same time, if you're a strict dogmatist, whether you're Anglican or something else, you're going to be irritated by Lewis because he doesn't go far enough. You want him to just go the rest of the way and say all the things you believe. He was committed to this idea he called a deep church, or the main hallway off of which all the hallways stemmed. And while I think he believed there was value in inviting people to enter through one of those doors into a church tradition, he didn't want you to stay in the hallway forever. But he felt like it was his particular calling and work, at least as far as the BBC would let him, to invite people into just the main corridor. So if you understand those senses of his project, then a lot of the nonsense complaints of why didn't you do this just kind of disappear. Cole and Terry, we've all done higher academic work, and you have to give a defense of a paper, and a professor will ask you some nitpicky question, and we all at some point learned that super important sentence, that's a good point, but it's beyond the scope of my paper. Mm-hmm. And that's what I want to say to most of the criticisms of mere Christianity. Like, that's a fair point, but write your own book. He was doing this one, and it's short, and it's pithy, and it covers a lot of ground for what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's a sense, too, that what Lewis is doing with this method that you've outlined so well, it's wrapped in a delight and a joy in the life of the mind and in the world that God has made that makes it uniquely potent as apologetics. McGrath comments, we mentioned the discussion over whether once Lewis is confronted by Anscombe at the meeting, does he give up on professional apologetics and write more popular level stuff? And McGrath's comeback to that is actually no. What he does is he consistently decides to write things that demonstrate that he enjoys these ideas rather than just having to defend them all the time. And you get glimpses of that in Lewis as an apologist, in that he is after what is true, good, and beautiful, but he does it almost in an even way. Whereas, you know, most apologetics is overly concerned with truth, not that that's a bad thing, but to the exclusion of the others, as opposed to this balance, the true, the good, and the beautiful are actually all meaningful categories for belief and worldview.
There's something to be said for presenting any point of view, but certainly Christianity, in such a way that the person you're talking to can still like you after you're done. John Lennox being another one in the Lewis tradition, when he debates Richard Dawkins, for example, by the end of it, they're laughing and cutting up. You'd think they were boyhood friends, because Lennox, while fiercely opposed to everything Richard Dawkins believes, does so in such a Christian and winsome way that you can't dislike him. And by means of, and I'm not saying there's never a time to be outspoken and fierce. In fact, I would say John Lennox does that, and so does Lewis. But to do it in such a way that you make Christianity more plausible by being more likable yourself, mm-hmm. by being a joyful warrior in the cause of Christ, that has a persuasive power all on its own that, well, as one of our mentors, Jim Baird, used to say at Oklahoma Christian Cole, don't be a jerk for Jesus. there's plenty of that in the world already, and we don't need any more. Arguing on Facebook is not your spiritual gift. It's okay. You can let that go.
Yes. I think the broad approach that Lewis takes, whether it's his fiction or his apologetics, is all going to be characterized by that. I mean, even his fiction has a sense of delight in it that we'll get to next time. But I wouldn't want us to not mention that there are other apologetics works besides Mere Christianity. I mean, Miracles, I would say, is probably his most formidable in terms of getting in that technical vein of things. But we can't forget that he also wrote The Problem of Pain and A Grief Observed, which deal with the problem of evil and suffering in different respects. Certainly, I would say, he's got a lot of essays on particular topics. My favorite is The Weight of Glory, which started out as an address. In fact, I might put Weight of Glory up pound for pound against any other work of Lewis's just because it's so dense and wonderful. But I want to read you guys a passage from Weight of Glory that's one of my favorites that illustrates yet again the approach. The content is always going to be good with Lewis, but what differentiates him is the approach that he's taking. And so he's talking about the argument from desire in The Weight of Glory. And that's where I think he probably states it in a pithier, more quotable way than he does in Mere Christianity, where he talks about our desires are actually not too strong, but too weak. You know, we've traded a holiday at sea for making mud pies. You know, that's quoted all the time. Mm-hmm. But later in the essay, he says, if we take the image of Scripture seriously, the imagery of Scripture seriously, if we believe that God will one day give us the morning star and cause us to put on the splendor of the sun, then we may surmise that both the ancient myths and the modern poetry, so false as history, may be very near the truth as prophecy. At present, we are on the outside of the world, the wrong side of the door. We discern the freshness and purity of the morning, but they do not make us fresh and pure. We cannot mingle with the splendors that we see. But all the leaves of the New Testament are rustling with the rumor that it will not always be so. Someday, God willing, we shall get in. And he goes on to say, what would it be to taste at the fountainhead, that stream of which even these lower reaches prove so intoxicating? Yet that, I believe, is what lies before us. The whole man is to drink joy from the fountain of joy. I think that might be my favorite passage in all of Lewis. And in some ways, it captures so many facets of who he is. I mean, if you take his ability with language mixed with his intellect, his commitment to Scripture and theology, and you package that with this pure vision that he's offering someone that can be found in Christ, this summarizes it. I mean, to me, that passage just captures so much of what Lewis is doing as an apologist and as a Christian thinker.
Since we're talking about favorites, my favorite deep cut of C.S. Lewis is an essay he wrote titled The Funeral of a Great Myth, where he eulogizes atheism, as he says, a great myth. He says, it just so happens it's not true. and he talks about naturalism in specifics and talks about like Big Bang cosmology, but he does it in such a way as to say, I really don't care about the science. That's not the point. The story's wrong. The myth is wrong. He says, so I have to bury it here in exchange for the true myth. And it's just a fantastic read where somehow he's quoting Yeats and Wagner to explain evolution to you. And it's just pure Lewis all the way through, and really an eye-opener of a different way to see the whole picture.
You know, I think what you guys just talked about, if you think about both of those ideas, they are hopeful. They bring in truth and beauty and the idea of vision, Ben, that you mentioned. They give you a vision. And I think that's probably one of the reasons that Lewis has had lasting impact. Cole, you talked about why has Lewis had such lasting impact. And, you know, there's some apologetics and certain disciplines. You know, you and I, Cole, know when you're trying to prove something mathematically, sometimes you can just grind it out step by inexorable step, and you get to the truth by just literally taking it by the throat and shaking it until you get there. And there are occasionally times when you get a glimpse of an elegant solution to a question. And it's as though C.S. Lewis reminds us there are elegant visions of life and not just the nasty, brutish day-to-day reality. I think that's one of the reasons he has had lasting impact is the way he goes about doing this.
Kind of as we started this podcast, when you get done with him, you really want him to be right. Like he's changed how you want to see the world, or maybe helped you realize what your intuition wanted you to believe to begin with. And while that doesn't make it true, it makes it possible for you to believe it's true. You know, the great question of apologetics is whether you can argue people into faith, and maybe that's not how it works, but you can definitely set some groundwork where there's a greater possibility for acceptance of a truth, a fertile soil for God to do the work that only God can do because your desire has been changed.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can't see the wind, but you can hear the leaves rustling. Yeah. And that is what's so beautiful about Lewis. And the image, Dad, as you said, the image, the vision that he presents, I think, is one of the pieces of his staying power. And certainly, that's nowhere better seen than in his fiction. And so on the next episode, we'll dive into Lewis representing and explaining the world through images and through his fiction. And so you want to tune in. We'll talk about the Chronicles of Narnia, which is just the beginning of Lewis's fictional worlds. And we'll see you next time on the So We Speak podcast. Thanks for listening to the So We Speak podcast. If you like what you hear, go ahead and leave a comment, leave a review, email us, tell us what you like about it, tell us what you'd improve about it. Thanks to all you guys who are listening, and we'll see you next week on the So We Speak podcast.